Minnesota. It's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else films. I'm your co-host Nick Cooey, and joining me in the flesh for this very special episode is Alex Cooey. Alex, it's great to be talking with you today, and kind of a novelty to be talking to you in person.
It sure is, now we finally are able to record this together after being apart for so long. And I just wanted to say welcome home, and I'm glad you were able to make it here safely, and that we're able to do this together.
Yes, no, it's great to be back home, and it's been nice kind of settling into the frigid January weather. Though I feel like our January weather has been pretty all right, considering winter's passed. And but I'm really glad to be here today to have our very first episode of 2021. Recorded together, and what an episode we've got in store for you guys. We decided that, of course, what would be a better, more cozy topic for two brothers to be talking about than a movie about car crash fetishists?
Well, actually, and it's funny that you use the term in the flesh, because it's a car crash fetishist directed by none other than the Canadian body horror maestro David Cronenberg.
Well, that's true. I mean, I hadn't even considered that, but that's right. Yes, we're talking about today, his 1996 adaptation of J.G. Ballard's Crash, which was a film that opened to tremendous controversy, which was fitting considering that the novel it was based on was also highly controversial upon its release in 1973. And, to start things off, Alex, like, you and I are both, I would say, pretty familiar with David Cronenberg's body of work. Less so with J.G. Ballard's body of work. Is that an unfair assumption on my part?
No, I think it's actually a completely fair assumption. In fact, I go so far as to say, like, with David Cronenberg, as strange and as controversial as this may sound, but he's actually one of my favorite filmmakers, and certainly I think one of the most audacious ones to have come around in the second half of the 20th century to 21st. But yeah, with J.G. Ballard, I've never really read any of his books. I haven't been familiar too much with his works, aside from his sort of autobiographical novel, Empire of the Sun, which in itself I know is a bit of an anomaly from his typical sort of dystopian repertoire, if you will.
Right, right. Well, I mean, and that is kind of what he was sort of known for, was, I mean, as a science fiction writer primarily, who was contributing his own inimitable flair to the dystopic sci-fi subgenre. And there's something really interesting since his death in 2009, there have only been more and more critical reappraisals of his novels, including, of course, The Atrocity Exhibition, High Rise, which was both of which were also adapted into movies. But when Crash came out, the film, it was only the third film of his. Of course, as you were saying, you know, the most high profile one was Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun. But Ballard was an interesting character. I mean, from what I kind of understand about his life, of course, we could get into his entire biography. But just as a brief summation, I mean, of course, he was, as a young boy, living in Shanghai, separated from his parents during the Second World War, was held in an internment camp as a prisoner of war during the Second World War. And he did initially study chemistry, I believe, and then he was also training to be a Royal Air Force pilot, but he ultimately came to write science fiction. And he was sort of writing initially sort of a little more palatable science fiction, from what I understand. And then, starting in the late 60s, early 70s, particularly with the Atrocity Exhibition in 1970, that's when he was beginning to make his own mark as a science fiction writer, and certainly garnering no small share of controversy for his brand of writing.
Yeah, that's right. And he started writing the content that would make up the Atrocity Exhibition following the sudden death of his wife, Helen Mary Matthews, in 1964.
Mm-hmm. And she was only 34 when she died, and it was pneumonia?
Yeah, it was. But yeah, either way, it was a huge shock to him, and and that seemed to have an effect on him, and also and on his writing, as you said. And you're right, like as the years went on, then like with his output, it certainly made an impression in the literature world, and even there were other kinds of like, programs or adaptations that were being made of his stuff. Like actually, even in 1971, there was a short film called Crash, not related to the novel he made conventionally, but actually it was a chapter in an exhibition, which was just basically a short film featuring him out on the road, and like there's his voiceover, like him saying samples from the book.
Right. He is extensively quoting the chapter called Crash from the Atrocity exhibition, though the short film, which was produced for the BBC, it's more just kind of him driving around London with an unnamed woman who's played by Gabrielle Drake, but it's interesting that wasn't the first or only progenitor of what would become the novel of Crash. And actually, in 1970, the same year as the Atrocity exhibition, he put on a well. Actually, I should backtrack really quickly. That the first sort of germ of the idea for Crash came in 1968 when he was working on what ultimately was an unproduced play. And according to an article that June Rose wrote for the Sunday Mirror, the production was described as something which dramatized the effect of car crashes on a, quote, liberating sexual libido, radiating the sexuality and energy of the victim who died in an intensity impossible to any other form. And then, as I was saying, that 2 years later, in 1970, he, J.G. Ballard, organized an exhibition for the New Arts Laboratory in Camden Town, London.
Yes, that's right, he did. And I believe the exhibition was like a bunch of mangled to destroyed cars.
Yeah, it was like three different wrecked cars that were presented without comment. And yeah, it really sparked a very aggressive reception from the audience.
Yeah, I believe there was actually the cars were all vandalized, actually, during the exhibition.
The cars were all vandalized, and even at the opening party, one of the hosts of that party was almost raped in the backseat of the Porsche that was included in the exhibition. So this kind of extreme reaction to the mangled car wrecks, really, that sort of violent, that fusion of violence and sexuality absolutely inspired what would become the subject of the novel of Crash, which, I mean, for anybody who hasn't read the book, it's nominally the plot of the book is it's almost identical to the plot of the film, where it's about a character who is named James Ballard. It's not supposed to be J.G. Ballard, but I mean, there is of course a little bit of he's not separating himself from his fiction, but essentially it is just about a man named James Ballard who is living in London and who gets into a car crash, into an automobile accident, and from there his life is forever changed in the way that he approaches his own sexuality with his wife and with the members of a cult led by this fanatical figure named Vaughn, who is obsessed with the reenactment of famous car crashes.
And what's interesting though is like we talk about like the sexual libido that's associated with car crashes, but like how a lot of people could argue that there's nothing sexual or erotic about car crashes. And actually, ironically enough, Ballard himself was in a car accident shortly after completing the book. And he said, actually, in a Q&A that he was at with Cronenberg in the fall of 96, that there was nothing sexually liberating about the experience.
No, and I think that that's the point with the book of... I read Ballard's Crash. It's the only novel of his I've read, and I read it about 5 years ago now. So my memory is a little bit hazy, but I know that, of course, the novel and the film, neither of the events depicted are to be taken literally. I mean, there is very much this allegorical concern that Ballard has with the role that technology has in our private lives, within the way that the body and the car have fused into what he called it the primitive algebra we use in our perception of all organic forms. And so the film is, and well, the book, I should say, the novel of Crash is something of a, it's an observation on the, like I was saying, technology's role in our lives and its growing dominance within the way we process our own bodies and our own fallibility. But it was nevertheless a very, very controversial text. In fact, there's this great publisher's reader's note. It's pretty famous now, where a publisher's reader read a manuscript of the novel, and their feedback was, "This author is beyond psychiatric help. Do not publish."
Yeah. I've read that, and I heard Ballard mention that story too at the Q&A.
He took it as a note of pride. He was he thought it was a sign that he had made an unqualified artistic success.
Yeah. And so when we talk about some of these themes, and if you especially know about Cronenberg, you know, his output to his body of work, you think, well, you know, it's no question that this is perfect material for him. But apparently, like, when we were looking into, like, the background history of the film, apparently Cronenberg was initially very reluctant to adapt to Crash into a movie.
Well, that's right. I mean, to kind of backtrack a little bit from that, I mean, really, the earliest kind of genesis of Crash as a film, I mean, I guess we would have to trace back to 1980, when Cronenberg first met who would become the film's producer, Jeremy Thomas. And they met at the 1980 Toronto Film Festival, and they had a conversation about certain films they would like to adapt or to make. And Jeremy Thomas actually asked Cronenberg, what would be a film that you really want to make? And Cronenberg replied, Naked Lunch. And indeed, 11 years later, Thomas and Cronenberg collaborated on the film adaptation of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, which was controversial in its own right. I mean, of course, William Burroughs' novel is itself as a topic of controversy, and Cronenberg didn't shy away from its bizarre, aberrant sexuality and violent subject matter. But yeah, after they did, or when they were doing Naked Lunch, you know, nearing the end of it, Thomas, who is a big fan of J.G. Ballard's work, and actually ended up producing Ben Wheatley's film of High Rise, he gave a copy of the novel of Crash to Cronenberg. And you're right, Cronenberg was initially repulsed.
Yeah, he actually said that, you know, when he started reading the book, he actually couldn't finish it because he was so disturbed, which I think is very interesting to hear, like, David Cronenberg being disturbed by something. But why he was disturbed was how the medical terms that Ballard used in the book, like with the acts of sex. Like, as he said, there are lots of usages of the terms penis and anus and speedometer.
Yeah, I mean, it is... the prose of the book is very coldly clinical, and it's in the first person, which I think makes it even all the more disturbing, that it provides something of a subjective perspective, and that perspective is one that is distinctly removed from any sense of eroticism. And so what you have are these, you're afforded a similar degree of kind of medical remove when describing, as you said, bodily organs or extensions of the human body and cars themselves, and even medical photographs of some pretty graphic, brutal carnage from car crashes. But Cronenberg, he also knew that, like, he was afraid that if he read the book, he would want to make it into a film.
Yeah, and eventually he did finish reading the book, and then Thomas was like, later on, I think it must have been when they did M. Butterfly, and afterwards he asked, well, what's the next movie you want to make? And he said, like, almost impulsively, he said, Crash. And he even wondered to himself, like, why would I say that? You know, he couldn't comprehend why his mind went to that book. But he just felt like, okay, he had to do this. And, like, the process of, like, him becoming, it became a process for him, like, of developing the screenplay and then developing the movie, and just to going through that process, it was a journey for him.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then I know that the film was, it was ultimately shot in Toronto, Canada, which, as we noted earlier, that it's a deviation from the book setting, which was London in the early 70s, and it was shot for $6 million, so a pretty small fee, but it had a pretty solid cast of actors to help give it a little bit of prestige.
Yeah, and these actors actually were very much, they really wanted to work with Cronenberg, and they were willing to work for less than their typical salaries. Yeah, like, you have actors of high pedigree like James Spader and Holly Hunter, who just won an Oscar, and you have Deborah Carr Unger, Rosanna Arquette, Elias Koteas. And actually, you know, when Cronenberg was changing the setting of the book to Toronto, he actually felt it made a lot of sense, because when he read the book and was like reading the description of the cars, he felt like these were very much North American cars, so it felt like it was a no-brainer for him. And actually, when he asked Ballard if it was okay if he could change the setting to North America, to which Ballard was very enthusiastic about that.
Though it is interesting that the film does retain the protagonist in the film has the same name as the protagonist of the novel, James Ballard.
Yeah, and actually, you know, at that Q&A I mentioned, Ballard actually asked Cronenberg a very, you know, pointed question, which he's like, why didn't you name the protagonist David Cronenberg?
Yeah, and I think Cronenberg just said it never occurred to him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of gives a little indication of some of the subtle differences between the novel and the film, even though the film does follow the novel really closely in terms of plot incidents and set pieces. There are a couple of, you know, deviations we've noted, and a couple more that we'll get into a little bit later, but needless to say that the film was shot and it was finished, and it premiered at the 1996 Cannes Film Festival, and yeah, it was controversial, and I would say probably one of the more controversial films to screen in competition at Cannes within the last 30 years. And it also was the first film for Cronenberg to actually play in Cannes, so it's a good way to make your entrance.
Yeah, hell of an entrance. And yeah, it was such a divisive response that, of course, the film received its fair shares of boos and catcalls and walkouts. And it wasn't just with the audience who were very split on the film, but even the jury members, it was said to be split. Like, there were some who were very supportive of the film. In fact, they actually advocated to give it a special jury prize, and despite the oppositions of and the reluctance of the jury president to give it to Cronenberg personally. And the president happened to be a big-name filmmaker. Like, who was it again?
Yeah. Some guy named Francis Ford Coppola. Yeah. No, Cronenberg was talking a lot about recently. That information didn't come to light, that it was Coppola who really was incredibly reluctant, to say the least, to award the film. And I think he was even a little bit resentful of having to present the prize to Crash. But it did win a prize at Cannes, and it ended up also screening in the London Film Festival in the fall of 1996. Which, as you said, is kind of when Ballard and Cronenberg were giving that Q&A at the National Film Theater. And following its screening, and it hadn't received a rating certification from the BBFC by that point, but when it was screened, it certainly encountered a great deal of controversy from the British public, I should say British right-wing publications, like the Evening Standard and the Daily Mail. And the critic for the Daily Mail, the late Alexander Walker, he was very unkind towards the film. I can't remember what he was. I think he was calling it. It was made outside of the bounds of. He called it beyond the bounds of depravity. That's what he said for his review in the Evening Standard. And so, the Daily Mail and the Evening Standard ran these pretty relentless campaigns to get the film banned. And the BBFC, hearing their concerns, sought legal advice as well as the advice of psychiatric experts. And after much deliberation on March 18th of 1997, they awarded Crash an 18 uncut certification and allowed it to be publicly screened. But that really did not do anything to appease either publication. And they both reacted with what I'd consider kind of unfettered vitriol.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the hatred for this movie, like, some of it, like, the people who didn't like it, they really, really...
No, but it's... But, you know, they also, like... But just to give a frame of reference, you know, like, there were pictures of certifiers working at the BBFC that were published in personal details as well to kind of call them out as, like, these irresponsible, quote, liberals who were trying to screen offensive material, lurid material. And as a result of that, the Westminster Council actually approached the BBFC and said, we think maybe we'd like to make some cuts to this film. The BBFC refused, and as a result, the film was actually banned from screening in the West End. And I think it's just, you know, just one ironic note that I wanted to bring up, you know, is that last fall, when the 4K restoration of Crash was released, it was scheduled to screen in the West End at the Prince Charles Cinema. at the beginning of November, end of October, and then when there was another national lockdown, that didn't happen. So there's just, it's just unfortunate fate that's prevented that movie from having a screening there, you know, which is a real shame.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And it wasn't just England where there was, like, cuts or, like, bannings that were imposed on the movie. Like, there was even a Korean film festival that, you know, and usually Korean film festivals aren't supposed to show, they're supposed to show the movie uncut, the movies, but they actually made some cuts to the film, particularly involving some content involving, like, handicapped or disabled people.
Right. There's a character in the film, and we'll get into that when we talk about the film proper.
Yeah.
And that was one of the, but that was definitely one of the most controversial aspects or scenes of the film and of the book too.
Yeah, but then the controversy didn't like end there with the United Kingdom or even in Korea. Like even in the United States, like it initially was going to open in the United States in the fall of 96 alongside its Canadian release, but then Ted Turner, who was head of Time Warner, which owned Fine Line Features, which distributed the movie, he apparently really hated Crash and actually delayed the film's release.
Mm-hmm. And then the film was eventually released in 1997 in the United States as well, but to mixed reviews. And it was certainly a polarizing film. I remember we were listening when I remember there's a famous episode of Siskel and Ebert where Ebert and Siskel, they both get into a pretty big disagreement about the film. And Siskel really thought it was absurd and pointless. Ebert actually really was an admirer of the film.
I'm saying that the ideas in the film, said by the performance artist, that somehow this is a connection between life and death, yeah. That's
well,
a bunch
you know,
of hooey.
The movie doesn't,
it's hooey.
The movie thinks so too, Gene. The movie is about crazy people.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. The movie doesn't argue these people are right or even that they make sense.
But are they interesting?
Yes.
Not to me.
You've never seen anyone like this before.
I haven't seen a lot of people in bad movies before that I don't like either.
Okay.
And the film is kind of, yeah, within these last 25 years of its life, it's sort of occupied the fringes of I would say, kind of the cinema canon. I mean, you have some Cronenberg completists who have championed the film, and it has garnered several high-profile fans, including Martin Scorsese, who called it one of the best films of the 90s.
Yeah, and I find that interesting that one of Francis Ford Coppola's friends and colleagues called it one of the best films of the 90s.
Well, I mean, yeah, but I mean, that's just kind of a testament to kind of how the film was sort of, it was an unclassifiable film in a lot of respects, and I don't think a lot of critics knew what to quite do with it, so people just didn't really talk about Crash, and it sort of has languished for the better part of its lifespan. But then, as I was saying earlier, it received a 4K restoration in 2019. And with that, there has been kind of this spate of interest that's been revived for the film. And that's kind of rekindled this conversation now. And you know, this whole question about, is the film sort of worthy of cultural rehabilitation? And has time caught up with Crash? Or is it something, too, where it's sort of an odd curio in the body of work of a really curious filmmaker?
What exactly is your project, Vaughn? Book of car crashes? Medical study? Sensational documentary? Global traffic?
Something we are all intimately involved in. The reshaping of the human body by modern technology.
You know, I had heard about Crash for a very long time. I think I first became aware of it when I saw the cover. And like, you know, it just looked like, oh, this is a steamy erotic film. But also happens to do with car crashes. But then I didn't realize later that it was Cronenberg. This was until I became introduced and then really became a fan of Cronenberg as a filmmaker, and then knowing about the sharply divisive response that then I was very intrigued to see it for a while, and so I was looking forward to when we watch it together the other week. And
yeah, because this was your first time watching it.
Yes, this is my first time, and this is your second time watching it.
Yeah. The first time I watched Crash was completely on a whim. And this is one of those, I mean, this is almost kind of like a stereotypical weird travel story where I was traveling in Paris on kind of a little backpacking trip 4 years ago. And, And I was just looking at the Cinémathèque Française, and I thought, oh, well, I have to go visit the Cinémathèque Française. And, you know, if there's a good film playing, I'll go see it. And they had Crash on 35mm. And I thought to myself, you know, this will, yeah, why not? I'll give it a shot. And, yeah, it was an interesting, very Parisian experience, to say the least.
How was it Parisian?
Well, you know, I mean, the audience was very quiet and respectful and engaged and thoughtful. And, you know, there was, you know, I feel like the French were, you know, the audience I saw it with, it is would be less prurient than if I saw it with an American audience or even a British audience.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear, what were your initial thoughts when you saw the film for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Especially because, as I mentioned earlier, I had read the book, so I knew roughly what to expect. And, you know, the book is challenging because it's a disturbing book. And, because, as we were saying earlier, both because of the content and because of Ballard's very succinct and cold writing style. And I knew that Cronenberg would probably transpose that to a visual medium, which he did. And so I remember thinking to myself mostly, well, I mean, if there was ever going to be a film about Crash, that would be what it would look like. And I didn't dislike it, but I mean, to say that you like this film is for me it's a tough thing to do, because it is not by design a likable film. It is a cold, foreboding, very, very distant film in a lot of ways. And I mean, that really did stick out to me the first time I watched it. So of course I had trouble kind of grappling onto some sort of emotional register with the film. I don't know. Was that kind of how you felt when you first saw the film?
I have to say that was exactly how I felt. I mean, I remember too, like, cause I kind of expected it to be a cold and clinical film from what I've heard. And having seen some of his film of David's movies, I think kind of fall into that register, like specifically Scanners, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, just to watching the movie, like, you know, just seeing it with it and watching it as it went on. And then when the film ended, I was at a loss for words. I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. I wasn't quite sure what to feel, if I did, quote unquote, liked it or not. And it was something that I felt like it had to brew with me. I certainly knew I wasn't going to be one of the haters like the Daily Mail or anything, but it was just something that I had to let register inside my mind.
Right. And I mean, and I think it's a kind of film too that, like, I think the thing that is a key distinction between, well, I think the thing that is it's a challenging thing about the film of Crash is that because it's so cold, I think that there is kind of this misconception that the film has no emotion, which I think is false. I think the film, because the film is very much about James Ballard and the relationship with his wife, Catherine. And they're both very peculiar people, because as the film opens, we see that they both have this sort of routine where they have sex with strangers or with other people. And then they come back to each other and they sort of relate their kind of sexual liaisons to each other. And then that's kind of how they sort of, that's the extent of their sex life in a lot of ways. And that's sort of that use of communication to kind of almost kind of reduce or sort of compartmentalize sexual experience is something that they both have. But Cronenberg doesn't depict this as an overly negative thing or overly positive. He actually retains kind of this ambivalence throughout the entire film, you know, which I don't think is to be mistaken for neutrality in terms of any moral stance regarding like his personal tastes and these proclivities. But I think the one thing that I'd like to, that I think is a real strength of the film is its lack of a moralistic stance.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. In fact, actually, I remember even too, like, Cronenberg had said too in interviews, like, how, you know, he'd actually been pressured, like, you know, the producers or so, like, said, oh, you know, you got to make this a little more mainstream, like, you know, you got to make these characters more quote unquote relatable or so, like, couldn't they have a kid or a puppy or something? and he was like, yeah, but then it would have just been a fatal attraction kind of thing, and there's kind of like a moralistic kind of grounds. And I can imagine being like one of those especially one of those films in the early days of cinema, like they made in Hollywood, where it's like, you know, characters that seem like good-natured, well-intentioned people, but then they kind of fall into this sort of bad rut, you know.
Well, it's sort of like, yeah, conforming to, like, the production code.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is definitely a lack of putative sort of retribution for the actions of these characters, which is great. I mean, there's, like, one scene in the film where there's sort of this congregation at one of these events that Vaughn, the Elias Koteas character, is staging, where he and one of his acolytes, who's a stunt driver, whose name is Colin Seagrave, which I think is such a great name for a character, but they reenact the James Dean car crash. And actually, it's interesting that this is one thing that I notice now, that it's a subtle difference, but it's one subtle deviation when they incorporate even the fact that the mechanic, that James Dean's mechanic, Rolf Ruderich, he passed away in 1981, I believe. So that was several years after Ballard's novel was published. And so it lends a little poetic flourish to that scene as well. But what I was going to say was that, you know, their whole kind of congregation is broken up by the Department of Transportation, not the police. And that's about it. That's the only time we really, I mean, other than just kind of first responders at a car crash on the highway, that's the only time we really see the police in the film.
Yeah, and I thought that was very interesting, and I didn't think about it initially while watching until, again, watching the Q&A with Cronenberg and Ballard, but like how, and when David pointed out, he said he intended to do it that way, where he didn't really want the police's presence to be there, because he kind of wanted to, like, and this is where, again, it shows, like, it's just an indicator of how this isn't supposed to be taken on a realistic level. But, like, it's more like just seeing what would happen if in a hypothetical scenario, like, you have people with these kind of, like, erotic fantasies and they just want to keep going and pushing it further and further until they reach it to the maximum that they could possibly reach.
Right. And I think that that's – I think that that is visually conveyed in the film, too. Like, there's this sort of this motif with the cinematography in the film, that there's this recurring shot sometimes of the camera will track forward over a particular balcony, and you'll see that at the apartment balcony that the Ballards share. But there's also a scene in a car garage when Ballard and the character of Dr. Helen Remington, played by Holly Hunter, who Ballard gets in a car crash with at the beginning of the film, they both go to this airport car garage to have sex. And there's a shot that the camera kind of also just tracks forward and leans over the railing to look at a docking airplane. And that happens as well near the end with a particular shot to over a highway bridge.
Mm, yeah. And what I find interesting is, like, what precedes the sex scene is the fact that they two are, like, driving into a near car crash accident. So it's like almost like the thrill becomes a turn on for them.
Well, it's the thrill, but it's also, I mean, there is actually a very real phrase, and I was looking this up, but it's a phrase called symphorophilia, and apparently it is kind of a fetish, or sexual arousal, I should say, that which stems from being a voyeur to a sensation of immense tragedy. And then there is kind of this, so it has a root in psychology, but of course, as we've been talking about, like, it, you know, this film pushes that to quite an extreme degree, and especially, I would say, in the most, probably the scene that's the most provocative is one where Ballard, who has sex with several people, I mean, everyone has sex with each other in this movie, it's, you know, monogamy is completely laid to the wayside.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, I was going to say, I'll just say, because I think this is kind of amusing, but David said he actually knows in one screening, like, there's a scene when Ballard and Vaughn, they actually, like, kiss and make out. It was during that scene that David noticed a lot of men walking out of the cinema.
Well, apparently that was one of the more controversial films, or controversial scenes in the film, which, frankly, like, looked at today, it's really not graphic at all. But the other scene that I was going to raise up is there's a follower of Vaughn's named Gabrielle who has survived an accident, but she wears leg braces and she has a very long, conspicuously vaginal shaped scar on the back of her leg. And it's in the book, that the sex scene between Gabrielle and Ballard, and Cronenberg keeps that to a pretty faithful degree. And you know, and that was a real bone of contention the detractors of the film. And in fact, there was, when the BBFC was engaged in sort of its long process of trying to determine whether the film was suitable for public exhibition, there was a group of 11 disabled people, an audience of 11, who watched the film, and they were asked for their opinion on whether the film was offensive towards those who were disabled because of a car accident. And while the audience apparently didn't like the film, they actually found no issue with the presentation of that character of Gabrielle. And in fact, they felt like that there could be an argument for it being a positive representation of someone who overcomes their disability or to retain an active sex life.
Or if anything, she uses her handicap as a way to, like, further, you know, express her sexuality and just that sexual confidence in a way. Like, there's a, even before the sex scene, there's a sort of like this humorous kind of moment where they're like checking out some cars, and she is trying to get inside one of the cars and asks this guy who's kind of like,
who's he's one of the employees at this car dealership. Yeah,
the car dealership. And she asks, like, oh, could you just help me get in? And he's like, how he's awkwardly trying to, like, lift up her leg, which is covered in this leg brace. Like,
yeah, and the hook gets caught on the leather of the seat. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely, like, that strain of sadomasochism in there. And she does look, with her paraphernalia, she has sort of that, a little bit of a dominatrix outfit. And but I think and that's what's interesting about the film, is the way that the film sort of toys with this sort of this line of what can be considered maybe not acceptable, but certainly consensual. Because I mean, of course that is to say that there is a very clear distinction between what is consent and what is not consent. And what I think what the film is doing here is it's presenting the fetish of these people in a way that's not judging them because of their fetish, but it is providing a wary regard, particularly for the character of Vaughn, for this sort of fanatical, almost like a myopic sort of obsessiveness about sort of the control of the formation of the human body. Because he has this whole kind of spiel about, at first he's talking about how he has this project called the Human Project, and he wants the project to be about kind of the transformation and the evolution of the human body, you know, through car crashes. And then he later on recants that and says that, no, this is really just about about getting closer to a sort of sensation, a sexual release between the living and the dead. And I don't think the film or the book really, like, I think how seriously we are to take what he's saying is, I think it's left enigmatic and ambiguous. But I do think, like, he as a character is ultimately one who is, he's considered with certainly a wariness. And he's a menacing figure too, because he is, he's a figure who's unable to, he cannot view sexuality as inextricable from violence, regardless of whether it's consensual or not.
Yeah, I agree. And he just seems like, you know, it's interesting because even at that Q&A, like, Cronenberg actually said, like, you know, that with him trying to describe the project, you know, Cronenberg was like saying that was supposed to be an instance of like showing how Vaughn even himself can't be able to describe what it means, or he can't understand himself what the purpose of this project that he's conjured up is all about. But it's like how I think that the character Vaughn specifically would also, I think, indicate, like, how, you know, like, for people who call the film cold and clinical, it's like, no, there's actually some emotion to it, but it's like, it's an unusual kind of emotion. I think Vaughn is a character who's very much brimming with all this, like, emotion and this energy. Like, you can tell he's, like, this almost volcanic and imbalanced, like, a very, you know, kind of person who's just looking like he's going to erupt at any moment.
Well, yeah, he's definitely got a lot of this unfettered male aggression that's, I mean, even in his sort of uber, I mean, he's a very fit guy, but he's also covered in scars. And And there's even, like, this whole question about, like, there's one of the conversations that James and Catherine have during one of their bouts of lovemaking is she's trying to ask James to envision what Vaughn's penis looks like. And it's, again, sort of that it's the transformation of human flesh, and which sort of intersects with this question of human evolution and and also violent trauma, which is, I think, in a lot of Cronenberg's films. I mean, down from The Brood, but then of course also The Fly, but in Crash, I think it's maybe not the most overt, but the one that's like rooted in like perhaps the least overtly fantastical.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, honestly, like, I feel, you know, there's also that connection you can make of, like, a theme that Cronenberg loves to explore in his work time and again, of, like, the relationship between man and machine. But it's in a way that's very less fantastical than, say, a film like Videodrome. But it's still present in the movie because of, like, the relationship between not just the characters and their vehicles, but also, like, how what stuck out to me in the movie were a couple of sort of recurring shots where, like, one of these kinds is like where he has like the camera lingering on these mangled, destroyed cars, and as if they're like these extensions of the human body. And it just made me think actually of, you know, a saying like somebody said to me when I was taking my driving lesson, which is like, imagine the cars being essentially an extension of your human body. Mm-hmm. And I think that Cronenberg takes that, you know, to an almost literal to a literal extreme, but in a way that's not, again, as fantastical as, say, Videodrome.
No, but I mean, but that's something too that even the film explicitly evokes earlier when James is in the hospital and Catherine kind of has this sort of she makes this remark at one point about thinking about when people die and there are funerals, she kind of wishes that that they left the body out to be viewed longer. And I mean, and that is kind of what this scene where Ballard tries to go to kind of the police impound lot to pick up his wrecked car, and you see all of these wrecked cars. And in that way, I think the film is also, I mean, of course it's about it more than sex. It's about death. And that makes sense because you just mentioned earlier about Ballard's wife when he was writing Crash and the Atrocity Exhibition, that he was still reeling from the emotional and mental strain of losing his spouse at such a sudden age. And I think that, you know, without ever becoming morbid or maudlin in any sense at all, I think the movie of Crash carries that emotional core through. And there's this very mournful undercurrent in some scenes, especially between James and Catherine as they rediscover each other. And there's this, and I wanted to kind of use that to tie into Howard Shore's score, because we haven't talked about that score at all yet. And I think that it's a really interesting score in both his, you know, discography, but also in relation to his collaborations with Cronenberg, because primarily the score it's a contrapuntal score with a reliance on electric guitars, with some harps and sort of some percussive elements like a piano and just a steel percussion. But then there's these moments, like there's a scene after a pretty unnerving car wash sex scene between Catherine and Vaughn. And when James and Catherine are in bed together, and it's one of the few moments, there are a couple of moments, but it's one of the few moments where there's a lush orchestral swell that makes it's recognizably Howard Shore again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it's interesting, too, considering how, like, that's, like, it was a 14-piece orchestra, so it was, like, much more minimalist than, say, like, for example, his last collaboration, M. Butterfly, which I think had, like, was an 80-piece orchestra or so.
Yeah, 84-piece. But that's the thing, like, you go from 84 to 16-piece, and then, of course, you're processing, he was using also this large computer that he had since the 70s to process some samples for the score. And as he said, like, that would allow him to kind of help mutate the sounds of the film. And that actually, like, works into as well, like, both into this Cronenbergian as well as Ballardian vision of human mutation and manipulation through kind of the warped malleability of the very material itself.
Yeah. And, you know, what I find interesting, too, throughout the film is that like with these characters, especially with the members of this cult, you know, how they have the scars, they carry them almost like, you know, like badges of honor. And they, like, also when making love, it's like they display the scars as if those would be kind of turn-ons for their partners. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I found very interesting as well. And what I also found interesting when watching the movie is, you know, was, you know, too, that kind of mixture and blend of, like, the of man with technology. I think it's recurring in many instances throughout the film, and things like, for example, there's a couple of shots where you see, for example, like the outside of the of them driving, and you can see like on the window there's a reflection of these steel factories, you know, permeating across like the passenger or the driver's face.
Well, it's not even just in the cars. I mean, you see it in a couple of other instances, like in the Ballard's apartment when they're making love. There's definitely this overlay within the reflection of their apartment building of the skyline of Toronto as well. So there is very much this kind of relationship between industry and human body, and that's definitely something that Ballard was trying to focus on with the book. I do want to very briefly also talk about one key deviation from the book, and that is with when he's talking about particularly consumer culture. And I think while the film has a lot of overlays or overlaps with the book in terms of that regard, with of course with references to James Dean and the Jane Mansfield crash, there is one thing where at the end of the book, Vaughn's greatest dream was to die in a head-on collision with Elizabeth Taylor. And that's completely absent from the film. And frankly, I think it's for the best, because I think it would have been a little more dated considering that Elizabeth Taylor was a lot older than she was in 1973, of course. But then also, I mean, if the Daily Mail was going to have a fit over the film before, like, can you imagine if the film comes out in early 1997 and then with Princess Diana, you know, it would have, I think the film would have just been completely overshadowed by that tragedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was very much my mind thinking about as I was watching the movie. And I knew that in the Q&A, like Cronenberg did say too, that was the reason why it was a no-brainer for him to cut out the Elizabeth Taylor subplot, because of how he felt like that just she didn't like hold as much maybe relevance or significance like in the mid-90s as maybe she did even in the early 70s.
And it also, I think, you know, I think what it does is also, I think Cronenberg just isn't as interested in celebrity. I mean, it's of course he has an interest insofar as that it feeds into kind of his larger concerns with how it shapes our perception of the human body and of what we consider sexy. But I think he's less interested in that as much as he is in kind of more kind of the mechanical meeting with the organic, and which, as we've talked about before. And I think that it ultimately sort of culminates in this. I mean, compared to the ending of the book, I think that the ending of the film, it's a quieter, more. It's an ambivalent ending, to be sure. Like, whether it's optimistic or pessimistic, I think is completely up to whoever's watching it. But I do think that there is this sense of a couple coming to try to sort of come back to themselves, but through trauma and through the physical act of undergoing that trauma rather than reducing it to words.
Yeah, and though it's interesting because for me, and this is my reading of the ending, but I felt like with the last line of the film, which I won't say, and I know it's spoken earlier, like at the beginning of the film, but the last line of the film, I think the way that it's used at the ending, it's like it kind of implies that this is something they'll try again, as like kind of to achieve something, you know, like satisfactory emotionally and sexually. And it's like kind of like there could be two ways that this will end. And either be with like happiness or like it could be with total destruction and death.
Well, right. But it's that pursuit of that transcendence, you know, that and particularly within the milieu that Cronenberg and Ballard are painting for us of kind of this affluent upper middle class, you know, or upper class, I should say, bourgeoisie, of trying to kind of sort of figure out where they relate to each other as the 20th century comes to a close and the 21st century is sort of looming as this unspoken and mysterious still monolith.
Yeah, and I think it's a fascinating way to look at that angle of like as a film that, you know, came out near the end of the millennium. So I think, and it kind of asks that, you know, we kind of said this too in our 2000 retrospectives, but I think it kind of also would raise the question of like, what kind of species are we going to be, like in terms of our relationships to each other, our natures, our emotions, you know, what are we going to be?
Well, and how that's all going to be shaped by this advent of technology that's only just going to continue to accelerate. But I think that the great thing about Crash, the film, is that I think it does something that Jean Baudrillard, the French theorist, social theorist, he wrote about the novel, and I think it actually really completely applies to the film as well, where he's talking a lot about kind of the novel's use of technology, and particularly cinema and photography, and he's saying that that with the camera eye, it replaces time along with all other expressions of depth like affectivity, space, language. It's not an alternate dimension. It simply signifies that this universe is without secrets. But by that same token, he also later says that when he's talking about the world of hyper-technology without finality, is it good or bad, he asks. We can't say. It is simply fascinating, without this fascination implying any kind of value judgment whatsoever. And I think it's that open forum for exploring the violent and dark impulses which exist within human beings, particularly when it comes to the way that we're gradually learning how to process our own sexuality and the sexuality of other people, and come out the other side as fuller human beings and more engaged with one another and more, at least more cognizant of who we are in relation to this ever-changing, brave new world that we're occupying. I think that's what makes Crash, in a lot of respects, not just a simple intellectual exercise, but something of a really poignant film. And I think it's definitely a challenging film, but I think it's one that's absolutely worth discussing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And in terms of if you'd asked me if I'd recommend this film, well, I don't know if I don't think everyone's going to like this. I mean, I could completely understand why people would be repulsed by it. But I think for me, as I was ruminating on the movie, I came to the conclusion that, yes, I did like it, you could say. But because I think for me, it's an indicator again of like why Cronenberg is one of my favorite directors, and that he likes to talk about these themes about human connection, relationships, like with other humans, with technology, with illness, with death, with the change, you know, and the frailty of the human body. But he does in a way where he never, you know, I think what makes him so great is that he never tries to like hold your hand or try to like cushion it for his audience. You know, he always makes it very challenging, and he provokes his audience, but like in a way that's never a cheap gimmick, I don't think.
Mm-mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that there is this, you know, I think it's, even though it's a film that's very much of the 20th century, I think it has plenty of themes which have remained timeless when Ballard wrote them and when Cronenberg put them to film. And, you know, for the adventurous film viewer, it's 100% worth checking out. And I'm very, very happy that it's gotten a restoration, that it's been, you know, its reputation is being excavated as a well-deserved highlight of Cronenberg's really remarkable career.
Yeah, me too. So I think we should transition to now talking about recommendations of the week. And I thought I'd start with you first. Like, I was wondering if you had any titles to recommend to our viewers or listeners.
Yeah, it's I will say, like, I definitely had some. I've seen some great films this week, but it's kind of weird to follow up anything after talking about Crash, because Crash is such a singular film. But I will say I did see a film that, I guess the only thing that they have in common is that it also faced a great deal of controversy and even attempts at suppression when it was released. And this is a film that was from 1974. It's called About Some Meaningless Events. It's a Moroccan film by Mostafa Derkaoui. And the French title is De Quelque Événement Sans Signification. And it's not really, like Crash, it's not an easily classifiable work. I think the best way to describe it is like an audacious synergy of direct cinema naturalism with a formal reflexivity that follows this film crew who go around on the streets of Casablanca and they ask people what their vision is for Moroccan national cinema. And so a more conventional, though still fascinating film would have resulted from just a strict adherence to this sort of formula where we would just see conversations with people on the street. It's sort of like a sociological documentary format. That's like what Edgar Morin and Jean Rouch did with their cinema verite classic Chronicle of a Summer. But Derkaoui's camera strays away from the camera crew and their interview subjects to follow this dock worker named Abdelatif, who we will gradually witness, engage in this criminal act of violent retribution against his boss in a crowded bar a little over halfway through the film. And it's this transition between different narrative polarities of fact and fiction, of truth and myth, that are redolent of something like the playful to metatextuality of William Greaves' Symbiopsychotaxoplasm, take one. And that's only just beginning to kind of scratch the surface of what this film is trying to do. I think that cinematic intertextuality is certainly key to Durkheu's complex dissection of filmmaking as a tool in helping to form national identity. And actually, there are discussions which are held among the filmmakers following the crime on how to avoid succumbing to what they perceive as a classical, quote-unquote, style of filmmaking, one which sees cultural imports like The Big Boss cited as primary elements of the Moroccan cinema-going experience. But About Some Meaningless Events is also cannily aware of how the endeavor to depict societal ills and institutional corruption can stem from motivations incongruous with the autonomy of the very real people whose likeness are committed to celluloid. And, for example, the young Abdelatif says to the filmmakers at one point, "You can only film the things you never dare to do." And he snaps this phrase particularly at the director, who may perhaps be an autocritical avatar for Dekoi himself. And the motivations for Abdelatif to attack his employer they're not reducible to merely an anti-bourgeois reactionary fury. But there's certainly an anger that undergirds this film, and it was palpable in Morocco around that time, particularly in relation to the ruling monarchy headed by King Hassan II, which enacted very strict and very brutal suppression tactics against leftist activists following the 1971 and 1972 attempted coup attempts, as well as the 1965 student protests, which were brutally suppressed. And when Durkheu's film was finished, it never received a public screening in Morocco. It was banned by the government, which deemed it inopportune for Moroccan audiences it felt were susceptible to political agitation, so to speak. And it only received two public screenings that I'm aware of, one in Paris in 1975 and another at the Kourigba Film Festival in 1977. And it was really long thought that the film's negative was lost to history, that it was no longer existing. And very happily, very thankfully, the original negatives were discovered in the Filmoteca de Catalunya in 2016, and the film was then restored and screened in Berlin in 2019. And so I think for cinephiles everywhere, the survival of this very obscure and very rare film is absolutely a cause for celebration. I mean, despite its title, About Some Meaningless Events is anything but meaningless. In fact, I would argue it's an intellectually rigorous and carefully considered paean to the collaborative processes which fuel either filmmaking or a politically liberated sense of nationhood. It is, as a character notes in the film, if the artist is the man who anticipates the occasion, then Durkheu proves himself with this film as an iconoclast who taps into a plethora of issues surrounding political filmmaking that are just as relevant today as they were nearly 50 years ago when he shot this masterwork. It's a really remarkable achievement. It's available to stream on Mubi for anybody who's a subscriber. And I know it's already January, but it's shaping up to be one of my very favorite films that I've seen so far this year. I really, really enjoyed it.
Sure you're not being a little premature with that thought?
it's setting a high bar. Let's just put it like that.
Yeah, well, you know, your description of the movie made me think of, like, one of the key lessons I learned from, like, when I first went to college and, like, was taking film classes, international film classes. We'd watch all these international movies, and then, after finishing it, the professor would then give us, like, historical and social context of what was going on with the country during the time when the movies were made. So it gives an understanding of why they're made the way they were. So I think I was thinking of that the way you described this film, because I think it's then so wonderful when something that was considered lost can be found. It's like almost this artifact, this piece of, like, it's very significant to Moroccan history.
Right. It's a time capsule. And but it's a time capsule which simultaneously feels timeless. And I think that that's both formally and politically. And I think that that's the sign of a great and daringly audacious work of art. So I loved it. But what about you, Alex? Did you watch any political cinema?
Well, I did watch something that you could argue is a little political. And what it does have in common with Crash is that it was directed by a Canadian.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, but this is actually, it was a documentary released in the Canadian cinemas in fall of 1988 and released in the United States the following April. It's called Comic Book Confidential. It was directed by Ron Mann, and it is, you know, on the surface level, when you hear about it, you know, it's a pretty straightforward kind of documentary. It's like covers about the history and the evolution of the comic book from like 1934 leading all the way up to 1988. And during that course, like, you get all these interviews with countless individuals and key figures who were who contributed to like the different kinds of directions that the comic book would take, from like William Gaines to Will Eisner to Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Robert Crumb, Art Spiegelman. But what I found very entertaining about the movie for myself is the fact that it takes what I think a lot of people could, especially I imagine in a, you know, in that time period, a lot of people dismissing comic books as like a kid's medium or so, children's entertainment. But how comic books, he reminds us how actually, you know, they cover so much different genres and themes or styles, like not from like the beginnings with Superman and Batman to like in the 40s and 50s with like these terror comics. And then you got the underground comics and then the more personal and autobiographical with the works like Mouse. And he still makes it engaging and entertaining to watch because of how he also talks about the controversy that comics would face. Like, for example, in the 1950s when they felt like some of these horror comics were like a bad influence on children. And there's actually this kind of amusing Confidential File propaganda film which shows like these boys reading these comics, and they decide to like almost in a robotic fashion reenact the actions they see in the comics of like, you know, smashing somebody's head with a rock, or, you know, it's like, and they're like, oh, this will turn our boys into vampires. And there's a 1954 Senate Committee on Juvenile Delinquency which covered about comic books and eventually led to the formation of the Comics Code Authority. So I think that scope and, you know, just talking about all these people and the way it does it with like this sort of, you know, with even they do transitions like with captions that say like, but meanwhile, and also has like the authors, you know, they actually read samples from their works. I think to give you a good idea of like, you know, how expansive or like what the material is like and what it can be. In fact, it's so expensive, my only gripe with it is that I think it doesn't cover quite enough. The film is only 85 minutes long, and there are like some people who Mann had interviewed, but he had cut out for time, like Carl Barks, you know, and there are other people who are just not in the film, like Alan Moore, you know, I think is a big glaring omission. But with that said, I still think it's, I think if for any comic book aficionado, it's a must-see. And I also think it might gain some appreciation from casual viewers on like seeing, you know, what the medium of comic books can be like. I mean, especially because now we look at, when we think of comic books nowadays, we think of like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I mean, it does acknowledge Marvel, but this movie reminds us that it can be so much more than that.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that there is something now where with the last 13 years of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, that isn't to say there haven't been good films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but definitely the perception of comic book movies, it's become more homogenous within kind of the popular cultural imagination. And so it's great to have this kind of refresher on the plethora of different stories that have been conveyed and expressed through comics and still are being expressed through a lot of underground comics.
Still to this day. And like if, because even beyond to what the film covers, even with things like Ghost World or, you know.
Yeah.
So, no, I really enjoyed this film. And also it's kind of interesting because actually it was one of, it was a film that was released on CD-ROM, if you can believe it. This is like a pre-2002 DVD release.
Wow, it was released on CD-ROM?
Yeah, and actually it contained 120 pages of comics and the complete comics code.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, if any of our listeners actually have a copy of that CD-ROM, I would be very impressed. And if you do have it, let us know if that's actually worth seeking out. I'm sure it's probably floating around on eBay somewhere for untold hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, I was going to say an exorbitant price. And if... you're interested, I definitely say check it out, you know, and take a look around, see if you can find it. I think that it's a good piece of entertainment.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. That's great. And, you know, it's, and if there's anybody who's listening who is a fan of comic book movies like Ghost World or, I'm trying to think, you know, now.
Or American Splendor. Harvey Pekar actually is also in this documentary.
Oh, there you go. There we go. Exactly. I mean, those are both great examples. Like, definitely let us know, because there have been a lot of really interesting films that have been focusing on graphic artists and their contribution to the medium and how that, of course, intersects with cinema, because they are pictorially almost consonant with one another. And yeah, otherwise, you know, if you're looking for a little more challenging stuff, I definitely would love to hear more and more about recommendations for West African cinema, because I'm more familiar with Senegalese filmmakers like Ousmane Sembene and Mambeti, but of course there are all these other films that have remained obscure and are still kind of slowly making their way to the light of day. And it's really invigorating for me that this part of world cinema is being rediscovered and finally afforded more exposure to a wider audience. And if there are any major recommendations that any of our listeners have, absolutely put it in the comments below.
Yeah, I find it quite inspiring too. And I think it's wonderful that we're getting more access to West African cinema. So if you have any favorite of those, if you have a favorite Canadian director, whether it be Cronenberg or Mann or, I don't know, James Cameron.
Guy Madden.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I mean, make a Guy Madden, David Cronenberg double bill tonight. You're going to have a really interesting experience.
On that note, though, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you have a great rest of your day.
Yeah, yeah, of course. It's always our pleasure to put on the show. We'll see if we'll be doing some more in-person shows, but we definitely have more content to bring to you. This is only the first of what we know will be a very exciting 2021 for us here for That's the Thing. But until the next time, be well, stay safe, and as always, continue watching great movies.
Thank you, and remember, we are all in this together.